Suppose your child came home from school and told you a classmate had AIDS. How would you react? That question is at the heart of a new book by my guest David Kirp, a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. The book is called Learning by Heart, AIDS and Schoolchildren in America's Communities. Kirp spent a year studying how different communities responded to children with AIDS. He found reactions varied wildly between compassion and terror. In Kokomo, Indiana, the town leaders expelled 12-year-old Ryan White. In Arcadia, Florida, someone burnt down the home of a family whose three children tested positive. But in Swansea, Massachusetts, the town embraced Mark Hoyle and became the first community to voluntarily let a child with AIDS into public school. Kirp told me why the citizens of Swansea reacted so differently.
Critical to the decision in that town was the nature of the community itself and the nature of the people who led it in this tough time. Swansea is a small place where lots of people know each other. It's a town of 15,000. It's a town that's led by a superintendent who'd been off and on a teacher and principal and administrator for almost 30 years, who'd been everybody's coach or English teacher, a man named Jack McCarthy. And McCarthy decided that when he heard that there was this boy, Mark, with AIDS, that he was going to learn as much as he could about the disease. He had a kind of Newsweek reader's knowledge of the disease. And he learned. He called the people at the Centers for Disease Control. They were just about to put out the first AIDS guidelines for schools. They said, there's no problem. He talked to the state epidemiologist in Massachusetts, who sort of broke through the bureaucratic logjam there and said, absolutely, you should go ahead and admit this boy to school. And with that, McCarthy, who is someone who really likes taking decisions, decided this was the thing to do.
The same information was available to the residents of Swansea about AIDS as was available to the residents of Kokomo, Swansea being the school that admitted the student with AIDS, Kokomo being the city where the student was turned away. What are some of the factors in the community, do you think, that explain for the differences in how they reacted to the students in question with AIDS?
Well, some of the obvious factors that I thought, as somebody who spends part of his time as an academic and part of his time as a journalist, weren't there. It isn't that Swansea is a particularly liberal town or a cosmopolitan town or anything of the sort. They're really very similar kinds of places in lots of ways. A lot of the difference resides in the nature of leadership in the two towns. Nobody in Kokomo, Indiana, dreamed of calling anybody outside of Howard County. The state hadn't done anything, and that was enough for J.O. Smith, a kind of good country boy who was, unlike his counterpart in Swansea, new to the job and insecure. And when he heard from his dentist that the idea of having a kid with AIDS in school was scary, that was almost enough for him. And then what happened? So that you get a real parochialism setting in, and then what happens when the parents, when Jeannie White and Ryan White and eventually their lawyers take on the system, the whole situation hardens. So even as more knowledge is coming out all the time, even as yet more facts are emerging that ought to persuade a reasonable person that Ryan White is just a 13-year-old boy with a terrible disease who needs compassion and caring and not to be kicked out of school, nobody could listen. Because by then, it really was us versus them. By then, everybody in Kokomo feels they're up against it, that the world is against them. And they just can't listen to anything that anybody is saying.
You visited these towns after the decisions were made to accept or reject a student with AIDS. Do you think they would stand by the decisions if they had to make them again?
You get very different reactions if you go to a town which has welcomed a child with AIDS and you go to a town which has really fought against this. In the towns like Swansea, and there are numbers of them around the country, people are falling over themselves to tell you everything they did. They are proud. They think of this as defining who they are at their best. At the places like Kokomo and like the little town of Osceola, Georgia, that got so scared about AIDS that it kept a child who was HIV negative, not only didn't have AIDS, didn't have the virus, out of school because his mother was a carrier. In that kind of town, people are defensive, they're unhappy, they feel a bit of shame, and they hide the story from you.
In each of these instances, it was a local decision. It was made by the individual school. As an expert in public policy, do you think that there ought to be some kind of state or national policy that applies to how schools should deal with students who have AIDS?
It would have made life easier for everybody if there were not only national standards, as there are guidelines that the Centers for Disease Control has put out, but if there really was some leadership coming from states and particularly from Washington. I imagine what might have happened when in the aftermath of the burning of a house in Arcadia, Florida, one of the most notorious events, when three HIV-infected boys went to school and their house was burned down and they were driven out of town. If Ronald Reagan had actually had one of those fireside chats about how AIDS isn't transmitted and had had the Ray boys on the show with him and had really hugged them, how powerful a message that would have been. So not only leadership, but in the rule sense, but leadership in the symbolic sense of we care, we're with you, would have made life infinitely easier. As it was, people really were on their own, and it was hard.
What about leadership in the rule sense, though? Do you think we need rules on a state or a national level applying to AIDS?
Well, by now we have something close to rules. We have the CDC guidelines, and we have a number of court decisions that exist. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think rules might make these decisions even more routine.
So between the CDC guidelines and the court precedents that have been set, which way would a school be likely to go now?
I think most schools will try to keep the AIDS and children issue as quiet, as muffled as they can. That's what I get from talking to school administrators around the country. It's what I get when I talk to the people in the Hemophilia Association. Either administrators will say, keep your kid out of school, because if you don't, I can't guarantee that your house isn't going to be burned down and you're not going to be driven out of town. Or they'll say, it's okay to come, but keep it quiet. Very, very few places are willing to discuss the issue. We were talking about tens of children in 1985 when the Ryan White story and Kokomo and the Mark Hoyle story and Swansea were unfolding. We're talking about hundreds of kids now. We're talking about an estimated 20,000 cases of kids with AIDS by the end of 1991. And the reason those stories aren't being told isn't that AIDS has become routine. It's that people are so afraid to talk about it in schools because they see Kokomo on television, they see that burning house in Arcadia, and they don't want it to happen to them.
The population now that's being hardest hit by AIDS are non-whites, blacks and Hispanics. Many of the people with AIDS now are people who are intravenous drug users, and many babies are being born with AIDS. Do you think that that the kind of changing demographics in AIDS is going to affect the way that they're treated? And in fact, how sympathetically they're going to be treated.
It's the question with which I end the book, and I do so because you move in these stories from the kind of poster kid. Ryan White and Mark Hoyle are the March of Dimes kids for AIDS, and it's hard not to fall in love with them. It's harder for many Americans to fall in love with the abandoned children of a drug-using mother who drops the kid off in a hospital in Southeast Bronx and disappears someplace. But I think the challenge is the same. I think if people can learn from the stories that their fears are very much the same. They're kids, and they're kids with needs and concerns, and they're kids who have lives ahead of them. And the kid stories in turn aren't so very different from the grown-up stories. So if there's a hope for the stories that are told in the book is that people can rehearse in their own minds and hearts what it is that in a dozen or so communities around the country parents went through and teachers went through and others went through, and can learn that this isn't just a story about somebody else, this is a story about us. It's not just a story about cute white kids, but it's a story about who we are as people, and who we are as people is going to be determined powerfully by how we respond when someone who's been part of our community, part of our lives, says, let me stay here even though I have this scary disease.
You start your book with this question. You say, imagine for a moment that your own 8-year-old came home from school and told you a classmate had AIDS. How would you react, keeping in mind that you're going to be told that there's an infinitesimally small risk that your child could catch AIDS from this child? But it's not a zero risk. It's just an infinitesimally small one. I'm sure you've asked yourself that question. Has your answer to that ever changed? Has your answer always been, of course?
No, I've always hesitated at that question, and it's the gulp in the question that I think gives the issue its charge, its drama. I've never posed that question to anybody, myself or anybody else, who didn't pause at least for a moment and say, gosh, that's different from thinking about AIDS policy out there. It's as intimate as the question can be. And writing the book and working on the book was partly an enterprise in understanding what made for good communities and bad communities and what made for the possibility of successful policy. Part of the book was really an exploration and excavation of my own heart and feelings. And that level of feeling what those people went through is a learning process that I rehearsed during the day and in lots of dreams besides.
So you're confident now of what your answer would be to that question?
My answer would be yes, not only because this child with AIDS does not pose a real risk to my child, would I say, yes, that child should be there. It's another level of an answer. If I say, no, that child shouldn't be there, I am creating a much greater risk, and that risk is that I'm teaching my child a terrible lesson. It's the lesson that when you don't like something, what you do is you exclude it, you get rid of it, you banish it, you blame it, you point fingers at it. And I think that risk, the risk of teaching a moral wrong to kids, is so much greater, even if so much ignored, that it makes for me, by now, having lived with these stories for several years, an easy question.
David Kirp, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.